All right, I think we can get started. How's everybody doing? Very good. Everybody's caffeinated, ready to go? Excellent. Well, my name is Mallory Silva-Grondin, and I work at TraceLink. I'm the Director of Experience and Technical Communications. Today, we're going to talk about localization musts, as in the non-negotiables, in order for you to successfully localize, focusing specifically on the preparation phase. So we're going to hop right in. First, I'll talk a little bit about myself, and for those of you that attended the API session yesterday, this will be a little bit redundant, so I do apologize, but I'd like to let you guys know my story, where I come from. I encourage you to come meet me on break and tell me how you got into tech writing, because I think those are always interesting stories. Then we'll just look at TraceLink so you can kind of get a sense of our volume and our doc sets that we're looking at when we're talking about translating content and how many projects we're doing there. Then we're going to talk about the preparation essentials, the absolute must in order to succeed, and the importance of the vendor selection process. We got caught with a little bit of egg on our face at TraceLink and had to course correct pretty quickly. So I'll tell that story as a cautionary tale, so in hopes that you can avoid the same headaches, if you will. All right? Everybody's got a tech writer origin story. Very rarely do I ever hear the same story of this is how I got into tech writing. Every now and again I hear have a career in X and then I went and got my master's in technical communications, but I feel like it's always really interesting to hear how everybody kind of falls into it. So my story is that essentially I was an academic writer that accidentally stumbled into the world of software. So I was a history major and I had just wrapped my bachelor's degree. And I was immediately going straight to the master's and was going to be working on a thesis. And I had a couple friends that worked at EBSCO Publishing up in Ipswich, which is north of Boston. And at this company, they had basically every piece of scholarly content in their software in the world. So completely with no good intentions of going into software, I joined EBSCO Publishing in tech support for the benefit of getting that content. And lo and behold, during that time, I caught the bug. I caught the software bug and the documentation bug. And they had a brand new cash cow product called EBSCO Discovery Service, which is basically like a Google search for all scholarly content. If that was more accessible and open source, we'd probably have a little bit less fake news in the world. But unfortunately, it's private. So I quickly went into implementations there to help that new product see the light of day. We were trialing certain companies like BP International, Harvard University, and it was one of three of us. And what was really important about that implementation program is I was very focused on internal documentation and external documentation as an implementation project manager, which means getting the team to grow out of coordinators in addition to sending out templates to our customers to help them get their massive amounts of metadata and library holdings into our discovery service. I didn't realize I was tech writing at the time. Nobody explained that to me. I was still pretty green. And then my former implementation project manager had already moved on as a tech writer to Kiva Systems, which is subsequently acquired by Amazon Robotics about 5 or 6 years ago now. And essentially she said, hey, we're hiring. Come on over and do this tech writing thing. And I said, what is that? I don't even really know what that is. And she said, it's what you're doing right now. I said, well, that doesn't sound scary. Let's give it a go. So there I really got to be under who I call my Obi-Wan Kenobi, my Brandon Bell, who took me under his wing and taught me how to be a tech writer, from asking really good penetrating questions to writing concisely and a little bit of doc design in there as well. But what I really did was get immersed in the product line. A lot of people confuse me as a product manager. I was really fascinated by automated warehouse systems. So we had these little orange bots that kind of would bring product to people in warehouses as opposed to people going out to find product to put into orders. It was really quite fascinating. And all of a sudden, I got really hung up in the supply chain expertise. It ended up becoming a domain expertise of mine. And then a former Kievan had already moved on to TraceLink. The one regret I had at Kiva is I didn't feel like I got in early enough. I saw the startup get acquired, but I wasn't there for the startup phase. And Josh, who was a colleague of mine, was already at TraceLink, said, this is the Kiva, this is now. And it's supply chain operations software and management. There's a compliance end to it. And at the end of the day, what we do is really important. We protect patients with TraceLink. We make sure that your pharmaceuticals that you pick up from wherever, CVS, Walmart, are tracked and traced so that they are truly yours and they are not counterfeit, because we have 7 million cases of counterfeit drugs internationally every year. And that's what TraceLink does. And the mission sounded really cool to me. Very rarely do we get to make such a big difference doing technical writing and in software. So I chomped at the bit and said, sounds like the right time. So I dove in. And one thing you hear about startups is every year in a startup is about 4 years to 5 years of experience. And underneath this, what we call Malbun, there's a lot of gray hairs, and I have that to prove that that is absolutely true. And we learned a lot. We learned about writing. We talked about APIs yesterday. We learned a whole lot about the vendor selection process for localization, which is what we're going to talk about today. We've done things with Agile. We've done things with making technical communications one of the most valued teams at TraceLink, which is very rare. Our CEO projects our analytics, all this other stuff. And these are all other talks I could do, but today we're going to focus on the localization piece. But that startup background, that milieu, if you will, that's really important here, because in a startup, you're going 1,000 miles a minute. You don't have the time to make really important decisions like who is going to translate our content. You have to think fast. You have to think on your toes. And if you make the wrong choice, you have to course correct very quickly. There's usually a lot of money at stake, and the time frame is usually tight. So we're going to talk about that story today. And at TraceLink, I started off writing APIs, which I won't go into because we talked about that yesterday. Then I took over the technical then publications team, which we rebranded as TechCom. And we grew that team out. It was two of us. We've grown it from 2 to 9. And then most recently, and recently I mean within the last 2 weeks, I temporarily went insane and decided to also take on the user experience design team because I think that's apparently a very good idea. So we have a lot of changes going on at TraceLink. We're kind of growing into that mature company. So we're going to talk a little bit about that story right now. So first, to understand who we are and what we do and kind of the documentation stats that we're looking at here. So again, we were established in 2015. And recently, we broke the teams out into special areas, very much similar to product teams that a lot of software companies do. So we have our application integration documentation team. The documentation I demonstrated yesterday in the API session, they're doing a lot of the API stuff almost entirely, from the asynchronous messages we talked about to the SOAP and REST calls. Our system documentation team is internally documenting all of our information for a new platform that we're building out. The team was seen as such a valued asset that they actually invested in an internal documentation team early to help the engineers and developers get ahead in expediting the building out of our new platform, which was really quite something. And then we have our user interface docs team, which is the most relevant to the conversation we're going to be having today. They are the ones that do all the online help, the knowledge bases, user guides, installation guides, all that good stuff. And as you can see there, we got about, you know, anywhere from 2 to 4 writers in each of those teams. So for documentation types, we got 60-plus sets. We've got online help, help centers, quick reference guides, IQ docs, numerous API docs. We actually own the master glossary. Marketing does not. We own that at TraceLink, another way to demonstrate value. We also own the internal engineering knowledge base, and we have what's called the release preview and release summaries, which in our world are release notes. But at TraceLink, all of our software has to be validated because we are tied to laws. So our release notes are actually one of the most, if not the most, valued and important documents that we own because our customers validate against that. So these are anything but notes. They're not concise. They're really validation documents, but we own that as well. And our tooling that we primarily use is obviously Madcap Flare. And then we use Jira and Confluence for some internal wikis, building out teams, knowing who's who. And we are integrated with Git for source control with Flare. The TraceLink Network, which is the product that we support, we have over 1,100 and growing customers, 274,000 on our network. I think we're going upwards now of 300,000 B2B connections. So we are a B2B company, right? We aren't consumer. That adds a lot of level of complexity, which is going to come into effect when we talk about the localization vendor as well. We currently have 5 solution areas and 26 in growing applications, and we have content across 58 countries. EU, as in Europe, we call it EU, they just went live with their track and trace and serialization solution this February. So we've had a mad dash the last year and a half to support that. So right now, when you look at our analytics, where we are hitting the most is obviously the U.S., but right and very closely underneath that is France, Germany, Italy. So we do have a very strong EU presence. Same with China. China's had a solution out for a couple of years. We have a presence there as well. And what is coming this year is we have Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. So as you can see, we're starting to really grow our global expansion. The ongoing joke is the sun never sets on TraceLink at this point because we just kind of keep expanding out. right? And that's just one screenshot there of one of our landing pages translated to German. So today we're going to talk a lot about preparation. There's a lot of other sessions here that will talk about the ROI of localization. All that stuff is super important. But you got to start from the beginning, which is how you prepare. In failing to prepare, you are preparing to fail, according to Benjamin Franklin. I agree with that. Preparation is everything. It's the thing that's going to help you expedite. It's the thing that's going to help you ensure success. And do we have any managers in the room or leads? Yeah, for you guys, it's going to help you sleep better at night. Right? So step one, establish your global scope. My CEO, he just likes to watch me dance around because he changes his mind on this all the time of what the scope is, right? But hey, new markets emerge. You got to go after those markets. Some of those markets have very serious international sensitivities. So you want to speak in their language, right? So step one, determine immediate company international goals, right? So what do you need within the next 12 months? That's the question to ask your C-suite. What are you thinking you're going to go after, right? Then the second question is, where are you going to go in 5 years? Because that's the question we didn't ask up front. Very important question. That could change how you're writing, right? You can write differently to prepare for this. It can change your resourcing and what you need to ask for assistance. It also may change who you pick as a vendor, because certain vendors have certain specialties in certain areas, right? So think about the immediate, but proactively think about the long term. And then, of course, understand those regional sensitivities, right? It's almost like usability testing, but on people. Think of it that way, which is if you have colleagues, right now we're 500 folks internationally. I can leverage a lot of my colleagues that are out of India and London to try to understand the things that we should be careful of so that we don't accidentally insult someone or write something in a way that could be misconstrued or misunderstood. So step one, if you have internal colleagues that are international or are not native to the U.S., just have a conversation with them. Buy them a cup of coffee. Pick their brain. It sounds silly. You can get a lot of information during that time to help you prepare. If you don't, if you're a smaller company, especially in the startup, maybe you're U.S.-based, what I would do is start doing some research on that. There is some content out there. And the best way to do that is to look specifically at your short term first. Otherwise, it can get a little too overwhelming. So when you're looking at that 12 to 18 month plan, look at the countries you're looking to translate into and start there. Still verify, though. Verify with the network that you're making here today at TraceLink. Talk to people that have done this before, other tech writers, other managers, because the best thing you can do is just have a conversation. It sounds silly, again, but the number one thing you can do is just have some conversations. Step two, streamline company terminology. So TechCom was added a little bit after the fact, and this is kind of one of our really interesting success stories that I really like to talk about. As we were preparing to localize the actual product, not even the documentation, just the product, and as we were writing for the product, we realized that our brilliant C-suite, who are made up of developers and engineers, started using different terms that all meant one thing. And when we went to go talk to our translation vendor, and when I just started reading this stuff, I was like, oh my goodness, we have to revamp the whole product UI and how we're talking about things. And typically that's done by marketing. But marketing had a tough time communicating with our C-suite, who again are primarily engineers, right? They couldn't get the buy-in because they weren't speaking the language. We were uniquely placed here, very uniquely placed. We are technical communicators. We know how to translate up into the technical and back into watering it down, right? So this was a really interesting case study. So as you can see here, we have a word cloud. So in our menu, in TraceLink, right now it says modules, and you go down and you can select any of your applications. Those have been called modules, services, apps, so many other things. Finally, I looked at our CEO, Shabir, and go, it's just an app. Just call it what it is. And guess what? If you change it to app, you don't have to translate it. It's internationally recognized, already driving down localization costs. That's buy-in part one, right? Using accessible terminology. That will help with your costs and your clarity when you're writing. So as you can see here, all of these words here were then watered down. So we have, you see a lot of different terms here, not entirely sure what they used. They were using very engineering-specific terms in a public-facing manner, including in their UI. talking about publisher-subscriber models. That is all under the covers. Nobody needs to know that. You just need to know if you're a user, if you're an admin, if you're a manager. You don't need to know the pub-sub model. That's a very engineering-centric thing to do. But it was exposed. We got it put back under the covers. So as you can see here, and I won't go through every single word just in the interest of time, but this is a really good opportunity, and I encourage all of you guys. We're doing a bit of disruption at TraceLink. A little bit of disruption. We're kind of breaking the mold of we're going to sit in our little tech comm bubble and we're going to put our headphones on, we're going to write our docs, and we're going to talk to our SMEs. We are influencing how we communicate within the entire company. And that is user advocacy at its best. If you look at some of these very engineering-centered terms over here, when you go to translate that, if it's not clear in English, I can assure you it is going to make it a heck of a lot even more difficult when you translate it into 22 different languages. Right? So put on your tech comm hats, try to get your buy-in, and we can talk about that on break if you like, and show your extra value. Because a lot of other folks that are up there trying to influence what are happening, they're not always the most technical, but we are, and we know how to communicate. And you can really influence and put the product on the right track here. So again, defining all acronyms. We don't like to use, we always say in tech writing, don't use acronyms, and then everybody uses acronyms in the end, right? But as our CMO likes to say, you're going to run out of letters if you're really growing. And you really will when you think about it. If you just keep putting on more and more applications, there's only so many combinations you can put those acronyms into. Try to avoid it if you can, but if you can't, just make sure they're defined. Make sure they're defined. Try your best to eliminate internal jargon. That's a tricky one. That's a tricky one to do. But if you put on, again, that extra value hat and be the word police, you can make it kind of fun. You can put dollars in a jar and go, you just used an internal word. In an external purpose, it goes in the jar, and then you all go out for drinks later. We actually did that. And you know what? People laugh about it. And my CEO is putting dollars in there because he kept messing it up as well. So you can have a little fun with it while also influencing things in a good way, right? We even had people using the wrong words just so we could go out. Yeah. And then, of course, the consolidations of multiple words that define one thing, especially if you're, and we're a little unique at tracing, if your C-suite, or if just your boss even, is from an engineering background, this is definitely something, it's an opportunity. It's more work, without a doubt, but it's a great opportunity to get good visibility all the way up, and it's a great way to get more value. I can't stress that enough. People, a lot of tech writers and tech writing managers I talk to, you know, they feel forgotten. They feel like they're not, it's super hard to get tech reviews. It's hard to do X, Y, and Z. We found a way around that. It's a whole other talk. They call that a mal talk at work. But this is a really good opportunity when you're preparing to localize. Look at the words that you're using. Look at the words the company is using and see what you can do to influence that. All right, so that's step two, streamlining terminology. Establish a writing style and standard. So some of this, you'll see these in other sessions. This isn't novel, right? So using active voice. I can't stress that enough. It is the number one thing when I am editing that I am constantly correcting, even to the most principal and senior of tech writers. It is a challenge. Why it's also helpful to use active voice is if you actually try to switch a sentence around, say it's not, right? Say it's either past or future, and you try to actually manipulate the sentence so that it's active, you save on word count almost every time. Again, you're driving down costs, and you're writing in a clearer fashion. Very important, right? Accessible language, unambiguous. We should be doing that anyway, right? I call that a duh bullet. Yes, we are tech writers. That is what we are supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be writing clearly. Consistent voice, organization, design, and project structure. We went through this a little bit in the API yesterday. So basically, global linking, I want to talk about global linking for a second. It's not just a good CMS strategy. If you have a lot of content that's going to be shared, and we have content that's shared across all 60 of our doc sets, guess what? Keep it in the global project. Translate it once to whatever language, and that's going to pull into all your other documentation. You don't need to do it in an instance of every doc set. Again, you're driving down costs while increasing consistency. It's a no-brainer, right? So what you can see with some of these project files over here is we have global topics in every project. So you're looking at the Content Explorer there. We label them very clearly as global. This helps MAD translations, by the way. And you pull that content in. And the other thing we do is, depending if you're on online help, API guides, whatever document you're using, that information architecture in your Content Explorer should be identical, right? Only the name should change. So for example, for every API guide that's written, you should have the message folder, and within that message folder, you have something for errors, guidelines, and samples every single time. And I'm going to explain why that's important. If you're doing online help, perhaps you have context-sensitive help, right, by screen. So do screen help. Screen help folder, put all your screen help context-sensitive files in there, right? Maybe you have use cases. Make a use cases folder. Put all your use cases. Stay consistent. And whether it's one application's online help or another application's online help, if that structure in your Content Explorer is identical, your translation vendor, especially if it's Mad Translations, is going to turn that around that much faster because they know exactly where to go. It's referenceable. It's referenceable. So it's not just important to write your documentation consistently. It's incredibly important to organize your Content Explorer with that same level of duplication, okay, because it's going to help with expediting those translations. Consistent voice, organization, and design. I would be shocked if you didn't have this, but you never know, especially if you're in a startup. Your style guide, your style and standards guide is essential. That has to be up to date. The translation vendor is going to take that. They're going to need that so that they understand the voice that you're writing in. It's also going to make sure that your writers, especially if you have more than one, are writing in a consistent fashion. Okay? Now, especially when it comes to design, we put design elements into our style guide. Not everybody does that. I recommend doing it because it helps the user and the translation vendor proactively understand how to interact, especially with your HTML5 output. Works for print as well, though, right? You can map out the information architecture so they know where to look every single time, same place. And then, of course, again, that project structure component. Be concise. Again, this is a duh thing. We are tech writers. We should be concise, right? That goes without saying. And then using a directed imperative writing style, I want to talk about this in a minute because this one's a little tricky when it comes to international sensitivities. So we tend to be action first a lot of the time because that translates for the most part very well to other languages. But this comes with a footnote. Some other cultures, specifically Latin-based cultures, can find that to be too aggressive. So again, that's why it's very important to understand your scope up front. It might change the way you write. More times than not, going with a directed imperative style is going to be fine. But if you're going into certain Asian countries and certain Latin countries, you do have to be a little bit careful there. It might change how you write it. Simple way of work around that, say you have one document that's getting translated everywhere, and it's fine to use that kind of a style. But let's say there's a couple countries you're not sure about. Write it in the same topic, leverage your conditions. You can do two different outputs, right? So that's, again, conditions, of course, are always our saving grace when it comes to that kind of stuff. But for the most part, you can use a direct imperative writing style. It's short. Again, you're going to drive costs down because you're charged by the word. But just be careful. Remember that first one. Remember your scope. Four, again, back to global linking. Establish your reuse strategy, but use it responsibly. We actually use conditions and internal notes. So to communicate with our translation vendor, who is Mad Translations. And what do I mean by that? There are certain words you're just not going to translate, like your product names. You're not going to translate those. Two ways you can go about doing that, either is effective. One, you have it called out in the master glossary that you hand your vendor. Hey, this glossary right here, it's a do not translate glossary. What they can do is they can load all of their terms up, and they can make sure that in their system, when those words pop up, they don't get touched, so you're solid, right? You might have some company-specific jargon in there that you also don't want touched. That's completely fine. You can generate, again, a do-not-translate glossary. Another thing you can do, and perhaps it's more of a one-off, is you can actually use conditions. What we do is we have a do-not-translate condition. And I would not recommend using this if you have a whole lot of content, because then you're just going to be littered with conditions. But if you have a couple one-offs that aren't a big deal, flag it as a do not condition, conditionalize it, and just give the translation vendor a heads up before you pass it over. That's a little trick for you. Again, the globally linked content, that's going to help you drive those costs down. If you can share it, put it in a global project, get that project translated first, by the way, and then you can pull that in. And you only have to do it once per language, right? And ideally, and this is what makes Mad Translations fantastic, when that content gets pulled in, they're going to QC it. They're going to check it. So when you have shared content that's getting pulled into your local apps project, they're QCing the whole thing. So they can go back through and make sure that global content still makes sense, right? And that's another benefit of using MAD translations. They understand how the whole global linking thing works. So they know to pull the pieces of the puzzle all together before conducting their QC, right? Snippets. This is what not to do. You can use snippets. Don't use them in line, right? Because sentence structure changes for different languages. And what I mean by inline snippet is it's not a full sentence, it's not a full code block. So what some of the API writers were doing is they were starting with this error occurs if, and that was a snippet, and then they would end the sentence. Doesn't work. It's a nightmare for the vendors. Don't do it. Because the structure changes per country or per region. It's not always a clean translation, and then they have to rework the whole thing anyway. So it's work that will go unneeded. But snippets, when it's a full snippet, a full sentence, a full paragraph, another way to drive down localization costs and ensure consistency, right? Use them. Variables. Do not use them as a snippet replacement. Some people tried to get too creative. They tried to go too far over to the right to drive down those costs, right? And they started plugging in variables instead of using snippets or global content. Again, doesn't always work in line, and it ends up having to get reworked anyway. So don't use that. I would highly recommend against that. And then, of course, and this is always something, typically it's talked about in other sessions, but using layered images with keys. What I mean by that, when you have diagrams, we have a lot of diagrams just because we have supply chain operations. There's a lot to do there visually that's more helpful to our users. Is, making sure, of course, that it's layered, but don't put text if you can help it right within those diagrams. Make a key, right? 1, 2. Then that way that text is editable. It expedites the translation. And I keep talking about expediting translation. We work very fast at TraceLink. We have patches that go out almost every week. We release big releases anywhere between 6 to 8 times a year. It does take time to get these things translated. The more things you do in the preparation stage, like having your style and standards guide ready, having a master glossary ready, or having a do not translate glossary ready, and having diagrams that all you have to do is just edit the key. Those are things that are going to save you a ton of time so that your content comes back for that release, right? Again, value shown. A lot of companies will trail. They will release the product localized and translated, and the documentation will follow after the fact. TraceLink, we're actually doing it the other way around. We've released the documentation because they want to do product enhancements before the UI, right? That's extra value add. We were speaking the language before the product was speaking the language, right? That was a good way for us to get in touch with some of our markets as well. So, again, value add there if you can just do some of these efficiency-saving things. In addition to, especially if you're managing a lot of folks, you got consistency there too. It's a no-brainer. Right? So again, establish that reuse strategy. We won't go into global linking. There are plenty of sessions here about that. I think there was one to link or not to link. If you're localizing, the answer is link, 100%. Spoiler alert. Okay. So, there we go. Vendor selection. Great things in business are never done by one person. They're done by a team. Steve Jobs. Anybody that listens to my leadership talks, this is a non-negotiable sticking point for me. You're only as strong as the collective. That also applies to who you pick as a translation vendor. And I'm going to get on my soapbox right now. So when you are picking a translation vendor, shift your mentality. They're not a vendor. They're a part of your team. They are an instrumental and crucial part of getting your content out in a language that you probably don't know, which means you 100% have to trust who that is. You have to trust your teammate, right? And we're going to talk about that. So prepare supporting documentation. We talked about this already a little bit, right? You've got your master glossary, your do not translate glossary. We also have, at TraceLink, an industry term glossary. You may or may not need this. This is optional. We are very complicated, the industry that we work in. Pharmaceutical supply chain is one of the most complex industries you can work in. There's a lot of terms, aggregate, commission, decommission, third-party logistics, supplier, each, right? These are all not common vernacular, right? But what we did is we proactively got an industry glossary together, not just for translating purposes, but to add context for those who are going to translate so they know what we're talking about. Right, so all that pharma supply chain jargon, we actually captured in a separate industry terms glossary just to add context for the vendor. If you're working in a kind of niche area or if your industry is complex, I do highly recommend putting the time in to do this. Not only is it valuable for your translation vendor, it is valuable for onboarding for your entire company. The entire company uses that now at any team level, any organization level, to help people get assimilated into the supply chain for us. So if you have something along those lines that's complex, there's more than just value add there for your translation vendor, although it is there. It can also be an onboarding tool for your company as well. And then what Mad Translations also had us do was use their tool, which was free, called Q-Term. So what we did is we loaded up some of these terms into their database. And sometimes we would translate a term, and sometimes we wouldn't. It was almost conditional. Or it wasn't almost. It was conditional. What you can do is you can load those terms up, if it's necessary, into their tool, which you collaborate on. You can put little notes in there on use this way in this instance, or don't use this way in another instance. So if you see anybody here buzzing around like Mike, ask them about that tool, because especially if your whole company is translating, not just your documentation team, there's a lot more terminology there than maybe you even know about. We drove that with the help of Mad Translations. So our marketing team was translating. Very important, right? But they have other terms that we didn't use that were kind of nuanced. We could, as a company, use this term manager tool to really get the entire company on the same page, which was super helpful. So that's another option as well. And then product information, always have a list of what your product offerings are, right? They should be in your glossary, but if they're not, that's okay. Just make sure they have a list, or if you have a list on your website, just point them to that, right? No need to reinvent the wheel there. Any mock-ups, screenshots, or product videos you can offer to help your translators with context, also super helpful. And then again, that writing style and standards, absolutely essential. So as tech writers, this is kind of easy, right? We love to write. Get your supporting documentation in order. But that's usually, and this is the lesson learned, that's usually where people start. But you're going too far ahead. You have to establish who you're writing for first. And you have to determine what the terminology set is. And that is going to drive what you document here. So the lesson really is, don't go straight to documentation. I know that's hard for all of us because that's what we do. You have to do your due diligence in truly understanding who you're writing for, because it may change in a couple years, right? So again, that's kind of the last step there. Now, for step one, right, we talk about establishing the scope. Very important. What kind of questions can you ask to establish the scope? Look, especially if your boss is busy or your C-suite is busy, there are some questions you can ask to try to get that information, right? What are my word counts and what are my budgets, right? Because there's always sticker shock when it comes to translating. So your CEO can say, I want to translate to, 22 different languages across 26 products. You go, great, and then you go pull your word counts and you calculate out an estimate. And there's sticker shock there, and they go, oh, that's what it's going to cost? Why, yes, it is. So then they reel it back, and they tend to reel back the scope. If you ask that up front, then you may save yourself a lot of work, right? Because they'll weigh the options, and that's their job. They'll weigh the options. What is the investment worth in certain markets? That's for them to decide, right? You just give them the data to help them decide that. Which vendors use our tooling? So this is another cautionary tale. At TraceLink, the marching orders were the entire company should use one vendor. To play nice, I didn't fight it too hard. I said, okay. With the vendor that was chosen, we were getting documentation back. And as you guys already know, we had some API documentation. The translations came back really quite horrific. Why? The vendor wasn't that technical. We went with who marketing wanted. Marketing content, as you all know, is entirely different than technical content, especially when you're working in a complex industry. Thank goodness I quickly course-corrected, reached out to Mad Translations. They were also having trouble, the former vendor, translating with our tool. There were huge code blocks that were getting missed. And it's because, as most vendors do that are outside of Mad Translations, they are exporting it, translating it, re-importing it, and then putting it back into your source. Something always goes wrong. The more times you're going to remove it from Flare, the more problems you're going to have, and it's going to be a nightmare for whoever's QCing that, and it's most likely yourselves, right? So we course-corrected. We knew Flare could translate either with Lingo or right there in the Flare source, and that's what we wanted. We also know they're tech writers. They're technical. They could handle our very technical content. So when we handed off an API guide for Mad Translations to do a sample of, they translated the guide, I sent it to one of my native speakers over in Europe, and they said, this is the single best translation I have ever seen for technical content. I had not been sleeping. This was keeping me up at night. This was the biggest strategic move I had to make at the time. Finally, I heard, I can trust this vendor. I was losing sleep over the other vendor going, we can't release this. We can't send this out. They're not getting it. We sat with them time and time again. We did about 6 conference calls to try to get the original vendor to get it right. It just wasn't in their skill set. So when you're trying to find the right vendor, make sure they know we're using Flare. And forewarning, a lot of vendors are going to tell you they use Flare. They have no idea. Yeah, I'm getting a lot of shaking heads over here. No. They know of Flare. They know how to sort of work with Flare, but they do not know the inner workings, especially with global linking. And if global linking is one of your strategies, not just for consistency, but to drive localization costs down, you can't abort that, which means you need a specialist that knows how that works. That's why we went Mad Translations. A very common question that you'll get asked when you're looking for a vendor, is it human or machine translation? You don't want to use machine translation. You want a human translating it. Otherwise, it's going to sound and read like a machine translation, right? As in, it's going to feel very cold, very disconnected, and things get missed, right? You want a human doing it. Does this vendor use translation memory? That's a very common question you should be asking. That translation memory is what loads up all your content so that you can get matches. It helps expedite and it helps drive your costs down, right? So just like you have your global linking, the translation memory is what the vendor is using on their side so that they have reuse options as well, right? So it's reuse both ways, and that's why I really emphasize this is a team effort. You're doing your part with global linking, snippets, shared content, supporting documentation. They're doing what's done on their end, which is loading up some of those terms and making sure that they keep good track of that so they can reuse some of that as well, right? So you definitely want to use a vendor that uses translation memory. How quick is their turnaround? So depending on how quickly you release, that's a very important question. You don't want the documentation lagging behind the product. A lot of companies do it, and they do it to their own detriment. The value with docs and good product is that you're there to help the user. If you're not speaking in the user's language, but you've released the product in their language, how left behind do they feel? And how much of a US-centric move is that? It's a bad one, right? It's a bad one. Try to keep it in parallel. So you want to make sure, especially if you're releasing frequently, that you know what that schedule is so that you can get it back in time. Right? Because there is a little bit of back and forth. You give them the project, they get you the quote, they give you the timeline, so you want to make sure that's easy, right? So make sure you know how quick their turnaround time is. And a way to verify that, because you can't just take folks at their word, you got to do your due diligence. Talk to references. Get 3 references from that vendor and talk to them and push on those references about what their pace was. That could be the single most important question you ask that reference. And what's their quality control practices? We would, with the original vendor, we would get projects back that they would say they quality checked, QC'd, right? But there were just huge blocks of content that were still in English. I mean, it was really quite frustrating. So ask what the practices are, because if they dig into their process and they actually have a good specific process, it means their QC is pretty good. But again, verify with references. Do a reference check. Make sure the quality is outstanding, and ask tricky questions with that. Ask tricky questions with that. So those are all very important questions to ask when trying to vet out your vendor. I had to go find this. So I had gone to, I think it was Mad World 2017, and there was a ton on localization, and it was great. But the gotchas weren't really called out. I had to hit my head on the pavement, and there wasn't a ton of resources out there for complex enterprise systems to kind of get the nuances of those markets, right, for translating. So these are just some of the questions I wish I would have known to ask up front. Some of them are obvious. The translation memory one, you're going to find that online. Human or machine translation, you're going to find that online too. But the word counts and budgets, especially for you managers, you can save yourself a lot of headaches there. The vendors on your tooling, again, watch out. They will tell you they know Flare. They do not, right? Turnaround time, very important if you want to go out with the product, and the quality control. The biggest, especially for those that have good extreme ownership over their content, you wrote it. You want to make sure whoever translates it does it justice, right? Because you don't want your content that you wrote out there somewhere in Germany and it doesn't make any sense, right? That doesn't help anybody. That's extreme ownership. Make sure that you have full faith in your translator to do that content justice. Even more less obvious questions. How technical is your content? We just talked about that a little bit. If you're writing really, really technical content, right? If you're like building a user guide on how to build robots, you want a vendor that is technical that can comprehend that, right? Or if you're doing API work. Not a lot of folks translate API content, but we do. You know, if you're a vendor and you're not used to seeing things like XML samples and such, you're going to have a hard time. So if you are very technical, ask yourself, how technical are we? And is that something we really need to prioritize? ISO certified. Do we need a vendor that's ISO certified? It depends sometimes what country you're in. It depends on what you're trying to do. It depends on how marketable you're trying to make your content in the country. So that's something you need to ask yourself, right? And these are all questions really only you and your boss can answer. Will the vendor translate directly in our source? If you have Lingo, you're fine. If you're going to go without, if you're going to go with a different vendor other than Mad Translations, you're going to want to translate it directly in the source. And what I mean is you want to take your Flare project and you want to toss it over to your translation vendor, because the second they export it and re-import it, you're going to have issues. I guarantee it. What are the communication and project management practices? This one was a big one for me. The original vendor was not proactive. We would find out that they had issues in the 11th hour. That's a nightmare, right? It's literally, why didn't you ask me that yesterday, right? With Mad Translations, not only were they proactive, we were doing, with the former vendor, we were setting up all the conference calls. We were doing a ton of knowledge transfers. We were doing a ton of walkthroughs. It was a ton of legwork on our part. What Mad Translations did, they're the ones that set them up. They're the ones that were communicating. If anything came up, they let us know immediately. And what that helped us do is it helped us mitigate issues before release time. And nothing was at risk at that point. They were very, very proactive. You want a vendor that's going to be proactive 100% of the time. You are already doing a lot. This is their game. Let them pick up the heavy lifting of the project management. They're the ones that recommended the Q term to get our company aligned as a term management tool. They were very proactive in, hey, we might have a risk here. Let's put a solution forward. Because they're the experts, right? They should be doing that for you. They're your teammate. So understand their communication and project management practices. If they are not responsive, you're going to have a problem. And will this company be a trusted partner? That's the single, again, most important thing that if you take nothing else today from my rambling, take this. You have to have 100% trust that your extended team, who is your vendor, is someone that will reach out to you proactively if there's an issue, that they're doing high-quality translations, and that they understand technically your products in addition to Flare. Absolutely essential. All right. I think the clicker stopped working. That's over there. There we go. And again, that verification step. Check customer references, read reviews, run a test project, and conduct native speaker reviews. So we talked about references. Minimally 3, if you can get 5, even better. But don't forget, it's just like when you're a hiring manager. References tend to be picked because they're going to say good things, right? So you have to be a detective. You have to push on things. If you go, how frequently are you releasing? Oh, we release all the time. How often? How frequent? What's your release schedule? Do you have patches? How often are you patching, right? Be specific with the questions to really get the right answers out for you. Reading reviews. Again, nothing wrong with doing a little due diligence and research there. You can find reviews for any of your vendors online, right? Run a test project. When you're trying to select a vendor, give them a test project. Most of them will do it. And make it a technical one if you have very technical content. You want to see what they can do. It's a great way to fail fast. You'll know very quickly if they're right for you or wrong for you based on what you get back. Right? And in order to know, you have to conduct native speaker reviews. Try to leverage internal colleagues that are either not native of the U.S. or that are located internationally. They're essential. They're very picky, at least at where we work, right? And that's the same for Kiva as well. They have a very high caliber, especially in Europe, of what that translation should be. So they will tell you if something is wrong. And if there's good feedback, there's always going to be feedback, by the way. You can pass that back to the vendor and say, hey, they mentioned maybe saying it this way because of this nuance. They will take that feedback, put it in their notes, and they will be able to handle that, right? Again, we got native review feedback from Europe. This is one of the highest quality translations I've read. That's after we switched over to Mad Translations. That had been a battle. I had been forging this battle to switch vendors for 9 months. And my boss was behind me, and she's the SVP and founder of the company. But they all wanted us on one vendor. It was a battle. It was exhausting. But one of my biggest victories is we course corrected, and we got to tell everybody that. The other vendor that was working with the other teams, they didn't get that level of feedback from the translation quality. So for me personally and for my C-suite, our heads were laying a little easier that night. And in comparison to the previous vendor to Mad Translations, and this is a really good indication of how to know if the content is good or not, this individual had to read the sentence 2 or 3 times to understand what was going on, but not with Mad Translations translation. It was once, it was clear, and they understood what was going on, right? Because as writers, that's the one thing we can't control, and as managers, we probably don't know the language. We're not going to know if it's good or if it's not. So hearing really good, solid, genuine, and enthusiastic feedback was the sign that we were on the right path with Mad Translations. And establish expectations, right? These are things you're probably not always going to know. Establish a single point of contact. You don't need all your writers reaching out to the project manager at Mad Translations. Pick someone. Maybe it's a project manager from that department. Maybe it's a writer that's a little hungry for more responsibility. Great management technique. Give them a little more responsibility. Have them facilitate the process of translation, right? They love it. They chomp at the bit for it. Establish a tracking system. We use Jira to track our stuff right now. I'm sure you could probably do it in Central as well. But essentially, you want to know when your deliverables are out for review and when they come back, right? So have a tracking system. Maybe you don't have a ton. Maybe a spreadsheet's good. We have a lot of doc sets. So we needed something to track of. All right, it's out. It left on this date. We should expect it back on this date. Okay, great. We got it back, right? You need somebody with strong project management to facilitate this. Because the first translation, which takes the most time, right, because it's the initial, is all fine and good. But then to maintain that going forward, you got a lot of balls in the air with those doc sets. You'll have, you know, maybe 3 or 4 out at a time. Some are out. Some are coming back. You're going to want a clear picture to see that, right? And depending on how big your organization is or what project management tactics work for you, you definitely want something. And we can talk either offline on break if you have some ideas or you have some more questions about that. And then proactively provide schedules and expectations. What's great about Mad Translations is they kind of did that for us, right? We were exhausted from the first bout with the first vendor. We told them, listen, we had, you know, communication issues, project management issues. They were very proactive with us, setting expectations of like, okay, we're going to do a conference knowledge transfer on this date, and then we will do your sample translation. We're going to get it back to you here. They were very specific, and they delivered on that. It wasn't just about setting expectations. They delivered on those expectations, right? So establish those expectations are step 3. We like to thank these guys because when we hit the, oh, goodness, this original vendor's not going to work problem. Mike, Meinrad, Andrea, they were all incredibly, incredibly attentive, sensitive to our situation, and they just really have done an outstanding job for all of us. And they unfortunately keep getting delayed as well with our product sets because our UI is going through a complete overhaul, so we have to wait for that to go out. But these guys were fantastic, and I recommend reaching out to any of them while you're here to understand a little bit more about what they do and how they truly do it well. And it's not me just sitting here trying to plug them, which would be obvious because we're at Mad World, but I'm telling you from experience, these guys knocked it out of the park. I mean, my 2016 and 17 were a nightmare because we went with the wrong vendor and we kept not releasing content. I can't emphasize enough that trust factor, and these are the guys you can trust. Okay. So, any questions? Yes. Ah, getting buy-in. Yeah, data. You want data. So who are you trying to get buy-in from? Your boss. Are they documentation specific, or is it someone else, like a product manager or a engineer? Uh-huh. Yep. Mm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they love that. Yes, so you have felt my pain. We're kindred spirits here right now. Yes, so the question was, just to repeat, is what do you do when you don't have control over selecting that vendor? Data. Can you conduct usability testing on the quality of those translations? That helps. If you can get at least two people to say, this is not great, that's going to help. The other part is, see if you can't get with these guys, right? See what the cost difference would be. Do you do global linking at all? Don't need it. Okay. So see a cost comparison, because this is also a difference between Mad Translations and some of these other vendors. They'll sneak little fees in there and stuff like that, and it will appear that Mad Translations is more expensive, but it's not, because it's more straightforward on the pricing structure. Compare pricing, work with Mike, see if you can't get an analysis going. The third part of that I would recommend is doing some kind of risk analysis on what happens when you don't have a trusted vendor. Increased costs, lack of trust with your users, and the list kind of goes on. So I would say if you could make an argument using those three kinds of data sets and pass it on to whoever it may be, and really emphasize to them if you can, we're going to have a problem even if it doesn't seem like it now, then you can do that. And you can use TraceLink as an example. I'd be happy to hop on any conference call with anyone to explain why this is immensely important. Sometimes it's just hearing it from an outside perspective, from a different company that's already been through it, to understand what the risks really are. Does that answer your question? Very good. Any other questions? Yes. Yeah, it's kind of shocking because they say they don't, and this is the gotcha to watch out for, which is they say they don't because part of what they do is human translation, but some of them still actually rely on machine translation to do some of the legwork. So just asking through reference checks and forcing them into that corner, double check with that, because they'll say they're human, but they might only be a hybrid model. So just be a little careful with that one. At this point, I would say it's pretty common, but it's still something you want to verify. I have a rule called never assume. It's my number one leadership rule. You don't want to get caught with the argument interface. Just for sanity, double check. But at this point, most of them are definitely using translation memory. Yep, and very good. In the back. Yes. That's a good point. They will try to own it. We've been through this. Yep. Yes.
I have a question about layered images.
Yes.
Does Flare support like Illustrator layers?
Ah.
Multiple languages, or is that something that can capture?
Good question. So the question was, does Flare support layered images? So we had done some in Mimic, and I'll be honest, I'm more of an Illustrator girl, so we would kind of do Illustrator and send them the AI files or the XD files. Part of that for me was image quality. So it can be done. It's just a little bit more painful and the quality wasn't as high. And I hate to say that, obviously. But it is possible, but I still go with Illustrator. Yeah.
So, for example, I have text in images on distinct layers in Illustrator.
Mm-hmm.
And you're able to sort of say, for the Spanish version of this project, for example, I'm going to use a particular layer.
Yeah, you can select that layer. Yeah. You kind of have to hack it, though. It's not... Yeah, you have to be kind of quirky. I'll find an example for you. How's that? Yeah, because, and that's why I went back, because it's built-in functionality with Adobe, right? So you have the layers built in any design tool. This one, you kind of have to hack it and make your own layers and kind of be creative with how you're labeling them. So, yeah, very good question. Any other questions? So managers in the room, do you have enough ideas on how to argue for the right vendor? Because that's really the goal of this. Meh? Yes.
Another thing that we've encountered is that there might be a good localization vendor in general, but they don't know claims to know our industry, like we're in the medical device industry, but we're very specific. We do hospital billing.
Mm-hmm.
Translators that really understand our content.
Yes. It's a huge problem. So that recommendation for the industry term or industry glossary, I highly recommend doing that. We have the same problem because of the pharmaceutical industry that we work in. It's very complex, and we are actually integrated with some medical device companies as well. That industry term base is really, really helpful for the translators to get some context around what they're trying to translate. So it can be a challenge, but that industry glossary can be, and it doesn't usually take very long because it's usually already in your glossary. You just kind of condition them, put them in an industry glossary, in an output, and that can actually be a huge, huge, huge help to the translators. Other things you can do is, right, the supplemental documentation, absolutely essential. Get that together for them. Keep your projects as clean as possible, right? One of the pieces of feedback we got from Mad Translations was, this is one of the cleanest projects we've seen, and now that we know one, we can do them all very quickly because it's the same structure, even though the content changes, in every project. That will really help expedite. Good. Any other questions? I don't bite, I promise. Even though I'm from Boston. Yeah. No? Nothing? All right. Very good. So I know you're all going to talk to Mike after this, right?